This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's often said that there is nothing worse for a parent than to outlive a child. In 1992, novelist Isabel Allende lost her 28-year-old daughter, Paula, to a rare blood disease that had left her in a coma for the better part of a year. Allende's new memoir, Paula, is about the months she spent caring for her daughter as she lay trapped in a state between the living and the dead. Isabel Allende is one of Latin America's best-known novelists. Her uncle was the Chilean president Salvador Allende, who was assassinated in a 1973 military coup. After the coup, Isabel Allende worked underground in the resistance movement, then fled the country. She now lives in San Francisco. Her novels include The House of the Spirits and Of Love and Shadows. Her daughter Paula was living with her husband in Madrid when she got sick. Allende flew to the hospital and eventually took her comatose daughter back with her to San Francisco. This is a reading from the days Paula was hospitalized in Madrid.
You have no control over your body, Paula. You cannot move yourself, and you suffer violent spasms like electric shocks. In one way, I'm grateful for your state of complete innocence. It would be much worse if you understood how ill you are. By trial and error, I'm learning to care for you. At first, the opening in your throat, the tubes and probes horrified me, but I'm used to them now. I can bathe you and change your bedding without help. I have bought a white dress and nurse's shoes in order to blend in with the staff and avoid explanations. No one has ever heard of porphyria here, and they believe you will never get well. Your daughter is so pretty. Poor child. Pray God to take her quickly. Patients who are still able to speak tell me. The atmosphere in this room is depressing. It reminds me of a place to warehouse the mad. Do you sense what is going on around you, Paula? I don't know whether you hear, whether you see, whether you understand any of the things happening in this madhouse, or even if you know me. You just stare toward your right, your wide eyes and dilated pupils fixed on the window where occasionally a pigeon alights. The doctor's pessimism and the sordidness of the ward are eating holes in my heart.
It's Isabel Allende reading from her new memoir, Paula. Why did you write this book while Paula was in a coma?
Paula had a very rare condition called porphyria, and sometimes patients fall in a coma, but after being in coma for a week or 2 weeks, they recover completely with no consequences. So everybody told me that Paula would recover. I thought that maybe during that time she may have forgotten things. You know, memory sometimes fails when patients have been in coma for some time. And I thought, I need to explain to my daughter who she is, where she comes from, who we are, all these people around her bed. So I started a sort of letter for her, and the first sentence of the letter is, "Listen, Paula, I'm going to tell you a story so that when you wake up, you will not be so lost." And then I don't know how or why, I started telling her my own life, a sort of memoir. And two stories intertwine in these pages, her, what was happening to her during that year, and the story of our life as a family.
When your daughter was in a coma, and the coma lasted, what, about a year?
Yes.
Did you believe that she knew that you were there, even though she wasn't conscious?
I don't know. I don't trust my imagination. Maybe it was just my imagination that sometimes I thought she could relate to me in some ways. But the truth is that I tried to get a yes or a no from her, let's say by pressing her fingers or blinking her eyes. But there was never really any response. I want to believe that when we took her home and she was surrounded by her family and cuddled by all of us, she was aware of the love, but I'm not sure.
What are some of the ways you tried to reach her?
I tried everything. We would talk to her all the time and telling her every moment where she was, what had happened, who we were. We tried through music. I recorded things and would put it with earphones so that she would listen it inside her head. But nothing really worked. And the only way of communication I had with her, really, was through instinct, intuition, and dreams.
When you had a dream, did you believe that those dreams were an omen or something that was giving you a deeper message?
I had a very significant dream when she first fell in coma. I was living in a little hotel near the hospital, 15 blocks away from the hospital, and I woke up in the middle of the night. I was with my mother at that time, and I had this terrible dream in which the voice of my grandmother told me that Paula had drank the potion of death. And I got up, dressed, and ran to the hospital. And the nurse must have seen my distress because she let me in, and I could go into intensive care and see that she was still alive. I think that at that moment, Paula died. Her brain died. And her body went on living, but her brain died. And I did not recognize the dream as a premonition. I denied it. I didn't want to believe that it was true.
Your grandmother was a spiritualist. Did you feel that you had spirits to believe in when Paula was sick?
Yes, and I summoned those spirits in a way. The spirits are the memories. Sometimes, I don't believe that the ghosts of the dead were around Paula, but the love, the memories were. And I summoned my clairvoyant grandmother, my sturdy grandfather, and especially Granny, Paula's grandmother, my mother-in-law, who had died 14 years before.
What about the Catholic Church? Did you have any belief that helped sustain you in Catholicism? You'd left the church many years before. Did you have any of that form of faith
I didn't
left?
Go back. No, I didn't go back, but I saw that faith really helped Paula's husband and my mother. So those people who were, who had faith, who were close to some religion, were stronger than I was. But unfortunately, I do not have that.
Paula herself had remained a Catholic, and she had been in a Catholic spiritual retreat before getting sick, and she was volunteering, I believe, at a Catholic school.
Yes. She was very curious about religion, and she was seeking for God all her life. She shared this with me in many ways. She would talk to me and write to me about this, but somehow I didn't pay much attention at the time.
Did you feel like, well, maybe you should summon up more Catholic feelings out of respect for Paula's Catholicism? You know how you sometimes you want to do what you think is right for the person who's sick, and that doesn't mean you can fake any feelings, but you're not sure if you should be trying to believe things out of respect for them.
I didn't try to believe, but I tried to comfort her with things that Catholics do. For example, she... there was a priest in the hospital, and I asked him to give her I don't know the word in English. In Spanish, it's extrema unción, that you give to the dying.
Extreme unction, yeah.
Yeah, and there was always a cross near her bed, and I tried to do the things that she would have done.
You write in your book that your mother was bargaining with God a lot while your daughter was
sick.
Yeah,
she was always pleading and bargaining and asking God that she would do this if you could just do this for Paula, or she offering her life instead of Paula's. You know, I did the same thing in other ways. I thought that writing was like some magic thing that could keep her alive, and as long as I kept writing, she would be alive. I didn't write in what my mother did in praying.
Paula had a lot of high technology when she was sick. There was neurologists and breathing machines and so on. But you also brought in spiritual healers to help her.
At the beginning, I didn't bring them in. They just came. I don't know how they learned about this, and they just appeared one day, and they started doing sort of psychic or spiritual healing. That I don't know if that helped or not. I don't think it did, actually. But when I brought Paula to the United States, I thought that technology could help her in rehabilitation. After a month in a rehabilitation hospital, they told me that there was nothing that they could do because she had severe brain damage. She didn't have a brain, really. And at that point, I took her home. And then for 3 months, I tried everything, Terry. All psychics, shamans that you can even imagine, herbs, acupuncture, everything.
Did you go through a full range of feelings about whether those that approach was helping her or not?
Yeah, hope first. And then slowly you lose the hope because you don't see any change. Fortunately, I had a wonderful doctor, Dr. Sherry Forrester, a wonderful woman, who helped me through that. She somehow allowed me to try everything. And then she said, okay, there's a point when we have to stop, because this has to stop at a certain point. You can't go on forever with this. So we decided it would be for 3 months. And after 3 months, she reminded me that we had tried everything and nothing had worked. And at that point, I think I just relaxed. I said, okay, I'm going to make Paula comfortable and just love her. And don't worry if she progresses or not.
And during this period, she was home at your house?
During the second part, because the first 5.5 months were in Madrid. And then I took her to California and I had it at home.
When did you decide that you wanted to take her back home with you to San Francisco?
I decided that the first day that she fell in coma, I was waiting for her to be well enough so that I could fly her home. I had already convinced my son-in-law, who is a wonderful human being, that Paula had returned to the womb and I was going to take care of her and I was going to make her well.
Well, how did he feel about you taking her away from Madrid and bringing her back to San Francisco? Because they were living in Madrid.
He agreed because he knew that he could not do it. He had to work, so Paula would have to be institutionalized somewhere. And we didn't want that. We wanted to be with her and help her through life and death.
Did you ever think to yourself, how long could you take her living in this coma, knowing that she wasn't going to come out of it?
I never thought about that. If she could take it, I could too.
Were you ever worried about the memories of her being in a coma driving out memories of what she was like before that?
That year was very long. And in a way, for a long time after she died, I could only remember her sick and dead. Because after she died, we couldn't find her husband, who was traveling at the time. And we could only reach him the next day around noon. So for a day and a half at least, Paula stayed at home in her bed, and I stayed with her. It was too long. The image of her body there, already dead and very pale, and that was fixed in my memory. And for a long time, I just couldn't visualize her alive. And that year of illness became more important than the 28 years of her wonderful life. But then my stepfather came. And he had put together pieces of film that he had filmed Paula during her life. And he put all this together in half an hour of a wonderful videotape in which Paula is dancing. I'm cutting her hair. We are running in the beach. And then I could see her again as she was.
That's really important, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very important for us as a family to remember her the way she really was.
My guest is writer Isabel Allende. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Isabel Allende. Her new memoir, Paula, is about her daughter, who was in a coma for close to a year before dying of a rare blood disease. Your husband at some point said to you that you're just becoming absolutely obsessed with Paula and that you were beginning to fall off the edge. Did you ever wonder whether you should be spending less time with her or kind of pulling yourself away a little bit? Did you feel you had any choice in the matter?
No, I didn't have any choice at all. I was there to take care of her because I was the mother, and it never occurred to me that somebody else could do it. And what I thought when Willie said that was that I should be more careful with the rest of the family. I should not dump on them all my anxiety all the time. I had to have better manners, really.
Were you with your daughter when she died?
Yes, I was in bed with her, holding her.
Did you try to do things to help?
No.
Ease the death, yeah.
No, because it was very easy. She just started to breathe slowly and then It took a long time, all day and all night, but she died peacefully. And I was holding her. And somehow it was a strange night. I have the feeling that maybe I was hallucinating. But I saw the room full of people, the dead and the living hand in hand. My mother, my stepfather, Paula's father, people who were far away, were in the room that night somehow. At the same time, Willie was there, my son and my daughter-in-law, and they had placed the two babies at Paula's feet on the bed. So she was cuddled and held by all of us, by the spirits and the living.
She had given a letter to her husband before she got very sick, a letter that said, "Open this after I die." Did you ever wonder what led her to write that?
We have often wondered what happened. This is how the story goes, how Ernesto, Paula's husband, told me the story. They were in their honeymoon 9 months before she fell ill. At the time, there were absolutely no symptoms of the disease. And she was happy, in love, in her honeymoon, 27 years old. And she had a dream in the middle of the night. She woke up, wrote a letter, put it in an envelope, sealed the envelope with wax, and wrote outside, "To be open when I die," and gave it to her husband. Now, why would she write that letter? I don't know. But it must have been a terrifying dream, a sort of premonition in a dream. I don't have a letter like that. My mother, who is 74, doesn't have a letter like that. Anyhow, after she was sick for a long time, nearly a whole year, I decided to open the letter. That was by the end of November, when I really felt that she was drifting away. So I opened the letter, and the first sentence in the letter is, "I don't want to be trapped in my body." So what did she see in the dream? I don't know. The rest of the letter is a sort of spiritual will in which she says that she wants to be cremated and she doesn't want her name in any tomb and she wants her ashes scattered in nature, and that is what we did.
Was it hard for you to re-enter the world of the living after your daughter died? Did you almost feel like it wasn't right? Do you know what I mean?
No, on the contrary. I have three grandchildren and I felt that I was betraying them. They need a joyful grandmother present in their lives. I think it's essential for children to have a grandmother or a grandfather or some older person that can dedicate a lot of time to them. And I was failing them. So I felt that I needed to get through this grieving as fast as possible and go back to life for them and for my husband too. We met very late, you know, and We have been together only for 7 years. Always we have the feeling that we missed so many years that we were not together. So I really wanted to go back to him too.
Writing about your daughter in the memoir, you've made public things that were very personal, I guess, particularly like the letter that she wrote about, the letter that she wrote about what she wanted done with her body after death. Did you have any qualms about printing the letter and about sharing certain things about Paula's life?
No, not really. At the beginning, I wrote this book without the intention of publishing it. It was meant for her. And when later, as the family and I decided to publish it, it was maybe time to edit and take away some things. But every time I tried to do that, I had the feeling that I was betraying the book. So I just left it as I had written it in the first place. And I don't think that it's offensive in any way for Paula. She was a very private person, but she was also a teacher. And I think that this long and painful agony, this experience of life and death, is something that is so rich in its content that many people can find in the book a space where they can get in touch with their own losses and separations and with the celebration and joy of life. And Paula would have liked that.
Do you feel like you've emerged from this any more fearless about death?
I don't have any fear of death anymore. I didn't have a lot before because I didn't contemplate death at all. Like most people, I thought that it was not going to happen yet. And I never imagined that one of my children would die. So I had not a personal worry about death. After this experience, I lost the fear of death because I understand that it is not the opposite of life. It's a continuation of life. And I know that nothing that I can do to protect or to control the circumstances will change the destiny of my children or my grandchildren or myself or my mother or whoever I love that may die before I do. I am not afraid of death. And when you lose the fear of death, there are very other few fears that you have. So in a way, I have become stronger. I feel liberated.
Before we end our conversation, I guess I'd like to just ask you if there's anything you'd like to add.
Well, maybe one thing that we should say is that, during that incredible year, it was a very intense time. Many things happened that were extremely dramatic. And one of them was that my granddaughter, Andrea, was born in the same room where Paula died 6 months later. So I had the opportunity to see both events, death and birth, in a contained space in a very short time. And I learned a lot with those two experiences. I had the impression that both were made of the same fabric, that Andrea was coming to the world with pain and difficulty, not carrying any memories from where she had been before. And I had the impression that the mother was like a door, and I was pulling this baby through this door from another world into this world. In the same way, 6 months later, I was in bed holding my daughter, walking with her to a threshold and trying to cross that threshold with her to see what was life there as it had been before for Andrea. You know, that the feeling that life is a station in a long journey of the soul. That was so clear to me with those two events that happened that year.
Isabel Allende, her new memoir is called Paula. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.